Hello, everybody. My name is Brady, and welcome to another wrestling edition of the Noisebleed Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about SummerSlam, NXT TakeOver Brooklyn 2, Bobby Roode, Brock Lesnar versus Randy Orton being a bloodbath. We're going to talk about Shinsuke Nakamura being the NXT champion, but first, we'll get through with the SummerSlam stuff, which is kind of an obligation until we get to the NXT stuff that I really want to talk about. But NXT is also a weird animal, where the previous takeovers are so exciting. This one was kind of predictable. I really enjoyed going along for the ride, but I literally called every single match. 6 out of 6, there were no surprises. Nakamura being champion was great. Asuka was great. I think everything is something that I called. I enjoyed every result, but sometimes, even if it leads to me being slightly disappointed, I like there to be a curveball thrown in somewhere, and that never really showed up in NXT TakeOver Brooklyn. But let's talk about SummerSlam, and let's skip to Brock Lesnar versus Randy Orton. The thing is, with SummerSlam, I did not watch it live. I got the results live from Alex, and it was cool. I was fine with that. I just really wanted to know the results in real time. And he told me about Brock Lesnar versus Randy Orton while I was at a concert, and I was looking at my phone, and I'm like, what's he talking about? He's saying, he's killing him. It's a bloodbath. Randy Orton is dead in the ring. There's fire and death and destruction. It's terrible. Brock Lesnar just murdered him. That's all I got. And then I'm just sitting there waiting to get home and watch it. By the time I get home, it's like 2 a.m. and I still really want to watch SummerSlam, but I'm way too tired. So I wait and I wait and I still don't get around to watching the full thing until like Tuesday afternoon because I have to watch Raw and SmackDown and I really want to see the aftermath of this stuff as well. So it's really a lot. It's a lot of material, and I wish I could have had the podcast out earlier. And I was in so much anticipation going into this, so I immediately skipped to the Brock Lesnar versus Randy Orton match when I started watching SummerSlam. And I was not particularly excited by the match. It's kind of like a typical Brock Lesnar match where it's him just kind of beating the other guy up, not really putting them over in a sense, not really getting in anything really exciting. If it weren't for the blood in this match, would you really find it to be all that interesting? If it wasn't a TKO ending, something that we've only seen a handful of times in WWE, last time we saw it, I think, was between Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn back in NXT. I think it was Our Evolution or something. I think that's the one. I'm not even really sure. That's prior to when I started watching NXT consistently. I'm pretty sure that was the last time it ever happened, and I'm not sure if there were any cases prior to that, but I find it very hard to believe that WWE has never done a TKO ending before Kevin Owens did it. But I really don't know any specific examples off the top of my head, so I'm just going to assume this is a new thing. I don't know if they're going to incorporate it any more from this point on. I would like it if they did, because in fights, technical knockouts happen. Characters like Asuka, who are very hard-hitting. Characters like Nakamura, who work strong style. Characters like Sheamus, who are really stiff. Having them beat somebody to the point where the referee has to stop the match, that legitimizes a character. And for somebody like Sheamus especially, I think that would be really good. Give him a match with Cesaro, and then just have him beat Cesaro down so badly that the referee has to stop the match. While they're in their best of seven, if Sheamus ends up winning in the end, I think it would be really cool if he wins in a very devastating, very hard-hitting sort of way, where Cesaro didn't give up, didn't get pinned, he just couldn't fight back. He just got beat too hard. He took a bad shot to the head or whatever. And I know that WWE likes to de-emphasize head trauma because that stuff is very serious. There's a lot of bad cases of people having terrible long-term brain damage in professional wrestling. So they ban moves like the curb stomp, which just have the appearance of causing head trauma, have no evidence that that move does anything. And let's just say this, let's just get that elephant in the room out of the way. The Buckle Bomb has injured both Sting and Finn Balor, and the Curb Stomp is the one that's banned. They might as well bring back the Curb Stomp, ban the Buckle Bomb, and they would look better. They would look better in that case. And if the Buckle Bomb is not banned at this point, that's kind of fucked up, because a move that appears to cause head trauma, it only has the appearance when it's actually a very careful, very gentle move in the way that Seth Rollins did it. Then you have a move that's actually hurting people, and if he continues to do it, that's a problem. Lance Storm. Yeah, he actually put out a statement about the Buckle Bomb, and I'll follow Lance Storm to the end of the freaking world, because he is a great wrestler. He understands the art of wrestling better than most people, and I just really think his opinion should be listened to. Here's basically what he said. When you're doing a move that really puts all the danger on your opponent, that's not quite responsible. The thing with the Buckle Bomb, you're throwing your opponent backwards, and it's up to them to land properly or they get hurt. Like, if you're doing a move where the danger is on the person delivering it, then it's not quite as bad. You shouldn't feel so bad about doing a move that puts you at risk. But when you're doing a move where all the danger is solely on your opponent, it's not all that great. And obviously, it's wrestling. There are going to be some moves like that. But we don't need the Buckle Bomb. It's not a pretty move, I'll just say that much. I think I thought it was a kind of cool move, but I won't miss it if it's gone. If they ban it, I'm not going to complain about it, because I know this move is legitimately dangerous. I know that this move actually has hurt people. There's two pretty high-profile examples at this point, and there's probably more from other people who have done the Buckle Bomb in the past. Probably not in WWE, because I believe that's a very indie move, but I'm sure plenty of people have gotten injured by the Buckle Bomb. Ban it. We don't need it. It's okay. I'm not going to complain about it. It'll be fine. It's a dangerous move. It's actually a dangerous move. And this brings up the endless debate about wrestling styles. A lot of the older people in wrestling don't like that the indie style is making its way in, because it's dangerous, it's not designed to work a full-time schedule, and I, to a certain degree, do agree with that. I think people should savor certain moves that are very dangerous and use those more at high-profile events, not use them at every single house show like a lot of these guys do. A lot of them are used to working a couple matches a week. These guys, they're working matches every single night, more or less. They just have a few days off, and it's a ridiculous schedule, and working a dangerous style on a ridiculous schedule is a lot, and it can shorten your career significantly. That's why somebody like Daniel Bryan is not wrestling anymore. And we have the back and forth between The Miz and Daniel Bryan on Talking Smack to reference here, where The Miz basically says, I'm still around because I wrestled a safe style. You're not around because you were reckless. And I think The Miz is very right in this situation. For better or for worse, indie wrestling has influenced the mainstream so much, now everybody is expected to do what they see in the indie scene, but those guys are not working the same schedule. When they get to the mainstream, then they're still working that same style that they've gotten used to, that people expect to see from them. And that is beyond tragic. We're going to have so many people that if they do have a long career, they're going to be like Terry Funk, where he's a mess. He's destroyed. He took so many risks. They're going to be like Mick Foley. Situations that, yeah, they have quite a legacy, but is it really a great thing, or is it tragic that they've broken themselves for this business? Do you want the people to have a decent life afterwards? The expectation from the crowd, when you hear the "you can't wrestle" chants, sometimes it's because they just can't wrestle, sometimes it's because they can't wrestle the indie style. And it's really hard to tell what people are expecting now. And it's hard to tell people, okay, we're just going to have a okay match. We're going to wrestle a slow match here. I know you're used to seeing this guy do backflips and 450 splashes as his opening move. But that's not what you're going to be getting here. He just needs to take a little bit of a break. you don't get that. You don't get any time off in that regard. And it's kind of a shame. It's kind of saddening because you know this is going to have a negative long-term effect. You have people like Bret Hart who come out and say, this is a problem, that Seth Rollins needs to work safer or else... that's not his voice. Seth Rollins needs to work safer in this crap or else somebody's gonna get killed. Yeah, we have people like Bret Hart who I don't think are coming from a genuine place. I think he comes from a place where he feels very self-righteous. He feels like the way he does things is the pure way of doing things. And he's always been like that. But when people like Lance Storm come out and actually explain to you why a move like that is a problem, you start to think, okay, maybe there is a balance to this. Maybe picking and choosing your moves based on their safety in relation to the event you're at is a good idea. But at the same time, if you do want to take frequent risks, make sure they're on you. The buckle bomb itself, that puts all the risk on your opponent. What if Seth Rollins did a move? What if he wanted to break out the Phoenix Splash every single time? Yeah, there is a little bit of danger on the person that is receiving the Phoenix Splash. But most of the danger is on Seth Rollins because he's doing a crazy flip. If he lands on his head or something, that's a big problem. But the risk is on him. If he chooses to wrestle that style, then he should make sure more of the risk is on him than on his opponent. We have people like Sting who work a generally safe style that, let's just be real, he probably shouldn't have been taking a buckle bomb. He shouldn't have been going through announce tables. That entire match was booked poorly. He wanted to keep up with somebody like Seth Rollins, who was at the top of his game at the time, who was definitely a little bit reckless. But I think the bigger problem to that is that it was Sting. It was a guy in his mid-50s. But in the case of Finn Balor, we're having a very different conversation. A man in his mid-30s, but somebody who is in the best shape of his life. In that case, there is no excuse for age. We're talking about the move there. So, Seth Rollins should be a little bit more careful when it comes to which moves he does. When Bret Hart says that Seth Rollins is a dangerous worker, I would agree in certain contexts. I would agree if he says he chooses the wrong moves, he does too many dangerous moves. If he says that Seth Rollins doesn't know how to do them, Seth Rollins knows how to do all these moves just fine. I think he can perform the moves well. I think he can perform them pretty much as safely as anybody could. But the problem is that some moves just aren't safe, and that's when we start thinking about banning them. But I guess we've talked enough about this. Just to wrap up the Brock Lesnar-Randy Orton conversation, I know I really trailed off there. There was a lot of blood. That elbow definitely busted him open. I'm assuming that Lesnar was having trouble busting him open and had to lay into him a little bit harder. Either that, or he didn't graze him as well as he thought he did, and he ended up laying into him a little bit harder than he should have. It resulted in a really cool image, but I was so concerned for Randy Orton. And the thing is, if Brock Lesnar did this to Dean Ambrose, I wouldn't really feel that bad, because Dean Ambrose probably would have wanted this. He would have wanted to be the guy who's laying in a pool of his own blood. Randy Orton did not need this. Dean Ambrose needed to be laying in a pool of his own blood. He's the guy from CZW. Have you ever seen any of his material from when he was Jon Moxley? If you want to look up some of his promos, he was actually edgy. When people say he's the Lunatic Fringe, I really just think of his Jon Moxley character. And I really want to see him recapture that. But also, when you see him in the ring, he's gotten so bloody. And he would not be afraid for Brock Lesnar to, quote, graze his head. Yeah, he would get some staples, but he would wear those staples as a badge of honor. Randy Orton, he's a safe worker. He's a professional, and I'm sure he's willing to take a pretty hard hit for the team if he really has to. But there are better people to put in these situations. And if Brock Lesnar had just made Dean Ambrose bleed a little bit at WrestleMania, it could have made a huge difference. That's one of the main reasons why I'm really disappointed in this. Because I'm thinking about what he was willing to do to Randy Orton, and I just wish he was willing to do the same for somebody who could really have used it. even if it was a shitty match, if Dean Ambrose was left in a pool of his own blood, people would remember it fondly for that. They wouldn't remember it so much for the match. I'm not going to remember Brock v. Orton for the match. It wasn't a very good match at all. It was just same old Brock until he started throwing elbows. He just beat the shit out of Randy Orton, and that's what happened. Now, we got to think, like, who's going to beat Brock? Who's going to beat him? Samoa Joe has come out and said he wanted a match with Brock at Mania, and I think that would be really awesome. I want Joe to be the guy to beat Brock Lesnar. Joe or Nakamura? Nakamura and Brock have a little bit of history. Samoa Joe, I think, would be perfect, though. I think you could have him come in as a face, as a really, really, really dominant face, and have him beat Brock, and then just go on an undefeated streak, and along the line, somewhere, turn heel, or you could just have Nakamura be the guy. Because Nakamura, first of all, he has an MMA background that is not all that different from Brock's. Neither of them are the most successful, but they're semi-successful. They have some wins in their brackets. They have a lot going for them in that regard. I mean, when it comes to wrestlers who are from the world of MMA, they're two of the more successful people. There's them and Alberto Del Rio, which I'm surprised they don't really bring up Del Rio, because I think he's more successful than both of them if you look at his record. I think he has more losses, but I think he also has more wins, so it's hard to say. He also fought under a mask, which was really weird for me to see. I watched a lot of Nakamura and Del Rio MMA fights recently, so I thought that was... It's so weird seeing them actually... Let's just say this. Del Rio is pretty much what I thought he would be. Nakamura, he is legit. And I saw him get his ass kicked so many times. But the thing with Nakamura, he takes so many hits and he absorbs damage like nobody else. And it kind of legitimized his wrestling character in my eyes. It was already legit. I already believed it entirely, but I thought that was just so awesome. Seeing him take such a beating, he would end up losing, but he would just absorb so many blows, and it was great. So, I think at this point we've talked enough about Brock versus Orton, which is not all that much at all for the 20 minutes I've been doing this. But, you know, I didn't really care to talk about Brock versus Orton. It's more about the politics surrounding it and everything that is Brock Lesnar in the business and the safety in the business. But overall, not so much to say about the match itself. So I guess we can move on and start going through the card in its actual order. So I didn't watch the SummerSlam pre-show. I just never really got around to it. None of the matches really interested me, sadly. We have Sami Zayn and Neville going over the Dudley Boys right before they decide they're going to leave WWE. It's kind of sad that they had to go out that way, but that's how it goes. They lose to pretty much a non-tag team, but it seems like WWE wants to put together some more throw-together tag teams. Tag teams that are made up of two singles competitors, but they get together and they find some success. That's what we get with Jericho. They're both singles competitors, but they're tagging up a lot right now. So we have Sami Zayn and Neville going over. We have Sheamus getting the first win in the Best of Seven series, and I thought that's how they should do it. They should have Sheamus get ahead and have Cesaro try to come back from behind and maybe fail in the end. Who knows? I was thinking that the Best of Seven series should turn out with a loser leaves town sort of thing, where the loser has to leave and inevitably sign with SmackDown. Because they've been teasing Cesaro going to SmackDown. He really wants to be on SmackDown, and I don't see why they wouldn't do that at this point. We have American Alpha, Zack Ryder, Mojo Rawley, and the Usos going over the heel teams of Breezango, the Ascension, and the Vaudevillains. I can only imagine that was a wonderful match. Having 1,000 people in one match doesn't get distracting at all. Sarcasm. But besides that, I don't know if there's anything else to talk about when it comes to the pre-show. Since I didn't watch it, I can't really say much for the technical aspects of the match. they're pushing American Alpha to the moon. And right now, I've recently learned that the SmackDown Tag Division is about to get a little bit more exciting. It seems like the Headbangers are going to come back. If you remember the Headbangers from the Attitude Era, they used to wear these weird fluffy bras to the ring. They were really kinky and they fit in very well with the Attitude Era. I don't remember much about them, but they did find a little bit of success in the tag division. And I think it would be cool to have them back, possibly as the top heels, since they clearly don't feel like committing to legitimizing any of the actual heel teams. They just want to push American Alpha, push the Usos, not push the Hype Bros, but they're there. They just kind of got caught up in it, and they ended up getting some W's out of it, which is cool. So, on the main card, we have Enzo and Cass versus Jericho. WWE realizes that they need more tag teams, and Jericho is perfect. They win with a leapfrog codebreaker thing, kind of like what the Revival from NXT does. I think it's similar. Like, there was a leapfrog over Kevin Owens that resulted in Jericho getting the codebreaker. What they do in NXT is like a flapjack codebreaker. The one that happened in this match was more coincidental, while the other one is far easier to set up. It's clearly not their tag team finisher. It was just a creative little finish they had, and the match was fine. Jericho expressed their love for each other after the match. They literally are like, "I love you, man," and they hug, and it's beautiful. These two are, they seem like they're having such a good time, and they're genuinely enjoying each other's company. At first, it seemed like Kevin Owens was not that interested in the tag team, and he was far less invested than somebody like Chris Jericho, who gets attached to people in very weird ways sometimes. But now it seems like they're really on the same page. It kind of sucks with Kevin Owens now being in the Fatal 4-Way for the Universal Championship, and poor Chris Jericho, he's left out of it, but he's going to help his friend to the best of his ability, I'm sure. I believe in Jericho. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing, and I'm not even joking here. I wish I had a friend who loved me as much as these two love each other. That's how I feel. They just seem so happy together. After this, we have Sasha versus Charlotte. This is the curveball. This is the one that everybody thought, it's obvious that Sasha's going to win. But apparently she had a back injury or back and neck thing going on. Vince McMahon says that Charlotte is reckless, and we've had this discussion about working reckless matches, and I think Sasha might be a good example. She's done a lot of things where she's done like the suicide dive, and she's hurt herself on that on more than one occasion, I believe. Her neck has taken a decent beating, so it's a big deal. It's a big deal, and I hope she takes as much time off as she needs to nurse her injury. It will probably only take like a couple months, and that's why we have Bayley on the main roster now, which is great. I love having Bayley on the main roster, but it caused her to go up prematurely. Luckily enough, Bayley did a decent job. She nailed it on Raw and apparently made Vince McMahon's day. He was having a rough night, and Bayley cheered up the old man. I don't know. I think it's kind of a really sweet idea. I think of Vince McMahon's heart growing three times the size when he sees Bayley and Mick Foley hugging. I don't know. I imagine that being kind of a cute little moment. So in the match, we have a couple cool things. We have this super obvious Super Frankensteiner spot where Charlotte tries to do the razor's edge off the top rope. And she lifts her up so high, and it's just screaming, "I'm going to reverse this. I'm going to do the head scissors thing, and then I'll take you down with the Frankensteiner." And it ended up happening pretty much exactly how I thought it was. Not the top rope. It wasn't off the top rope. Nobody's ever done that off the top rope. It's the second rope, obviously, because you can't balance yourself on the top rope while in the razor's edge. Charlotte also does the gory special, which I think is a really cool move. It's like, You get them in kind of a razor's edge sort of position, and then you start wrenching on the arms, which I think is a really cool submission. It's very underrated, and I hope Charlotte does more moves like that. I think creative submissions are what really can save the women's division, because a lot of WWE has moved away from moves like that, and they've really just relied on having moves that you can break out really, really quickly. They love sudden endings, and I think I think a lot of the women's matches are very classically done. Matches that people like Bret Hart can be very proud of. At least I hope, because a lot of them do work a style that he'd prefer they work. Not Sasha exactly. She's probably one of the reckless people, and he's like, I don't like this crap, slow technical wrestling. Yeah, Bret. But people like Charlotte, people like Natalia, obviously he appreciates her style because it's his style, more or less. And there was an exchange of finishers, and here's my little note here. Her shoulders weren't even down. That's what I was writing in the moment. Charlotte rolls off of the bank statement. It didn't even seem like Sasha Banks' shoulders were all that down, so that's kind of a shame. So then we have a backstage segment which got the internet going crazy. We have the four club members, well, the club guys. I guess Finn Balor's technically not a member right now, but all of them do like the too sweet thing, and they're like, too sweet, too sweet. And then Finn Balor kind of just shrugs it off, which I thought that was kind of a cool moment. He acknowledged them, but he's like, it's it was kind of a subtle thing. Like, he acknowledged them in a way that wasn't really disrespectful, and they're all smiling, and they're like, he knows, he knows. It's that type of feeling, and I thought that was cool. We have Miz versus Apollo Crews. Didn't care at all, didn't write any notes. Miz wins. I don't care about Apollo Crews, and I don't think the Miz could have saved this match. Apollo Crews is an exciting wrestler, but I need some sort of investment in the match before I care at all. So let's just move on to Cena versus AJ Styles. It was easily the match of the night. The crowd was all in on AJ Styles. There was this suplex spot, just as long as we're going into the spots here, there was a suplex spot on the ring apron, and that really bothers me whenever I see people do spots on the ring apron, because they really emphasize that that's the hardest part of the ring, and that's reality. That's what really holds the ring together. It gets softer the closer you get to the center of the ring. That's where you, if you're going to be falling off the top rope, you want to fall closer to the middle of the ring, because that's where everything starts to get a little bit more bouncy, I guess. It has a little bit more bounce to it. It has a little bit more, it doesn't have as much support is, I was about to say it has more support, but all the support is in the sides, and that's not where you want to land, and that always makes me nervous. Cena had an air of hopelessness around him during the match, and I kind of got the indication that he was going to lose from his face. Like, he seemed genuinely sad about it. He didn't seem sad when Alberto Del Rio comes back to beat him and beats him real quick. He seemed eager to get out of there. But in this one, he seemed pretty sad. This could be the end of the full-time John Cena. A lot of people are thinking, like, this is the end of John Cena in general. I don't think that's the case. I don't think he can stay away. AJ hits a torture rack bomb. That was great. Cena hits the big ending, which is Big E's finisher. They go from submission to submission. They do that stuff. AJ kicks out of an avalanche AA, which is great. Cena is dumbfounded. I think that was one of the best moments of storytelling in this match, where Cena is just sitting in the corner looking at AJ pull himself to his feet, and he's thinking, what can I do to put this guy away? I've thrown out everything I had. Styles ends up winning clean pretty quickly from that point, and that's what really, I really enjoyed that. And afterwards, Cena leaves his armband in the ring as kind of, I don't know, this is kind of like what The Undertaker did at WrestleMania, where he left his gloves in the ring. It was interesting because The Undertaker, prior to that, he was like, The streak wasn't my legacy. My legacy are these. And he puts up his hands, and you're just thinking like, okay, okay, Mark. But in the case of Cena, he kisses his little armband and leaves it in the ring, and now AJ Styles is wearing it around, which is great. A great heel move. I really do enjoy that. Cena was great for putting AJ Styles over, and I think that's what the fans saw after the match, because people who would ordinarily boo John Cena were giving him a standing ovation as he walked out of the ring. I think that's because they appreciate Cena putting AJ Styles over. It's like, thank you for putting AJ over. It's one of those sort of situations. Maybe they really just do respect his performance. People are really coming around to John Cena. Ever since his U.S. title run, people have started coming around to John Cena a little bit more at a time. And this John Cena sucks thing is really just something that's left over from a time where they respected him less. But people respect John Cena so much more than they did, and it just shows that putting a little bit effort into changing the way you do things, even if it's just a little bit based on your in-ring style, that can make a huge difference. And John Cena, he didn't go full indie or anything. He just worked a little bit harder at telling deeper stories in the ring. More people go over him. Now he's having this thing like, wow, John Cena isn't as good as he once was. Now he can work his way back up from that and be a little bit more believable. I think they could eventually get him around to being the 16-time world champion if booked correctly. If there's doubt in people's mind, if he really, I don't even know exactly how to describe it. I really do think they can do it, though. Let's move on. Let's talk about Jon Stewart. Why is Jon Stewart here? I don't get it. You know, when Jon Stewart interfered last year, I was hoping that he would end up being the general manager. I was hoping that they were going to make him like a general manager or something, because I love Jon Stewart. I do think he's funny. His comedic timing is great. But his involvement in this match was kind of weird, and it ended kind of funny. So the thing is, the club tries to give Jon Stewart a case of ring postitis. They have a bunch of jars for all the members of the New Day, and it's funny because they have a tiny little jar for Jon Stewart. And then they're about to give him a severe case of ring postitis when Big E comes out. The big guy comes out, as they say, gimmick infringement, kind of. But the big guy comes out. I wonder whenever they do stuff like that, if they purposely throw in details like that. Because I've seen them throw in a lot of little stuff like that every now and then, where they reference something that was kind of another character's gimmick shortly after they're gone. I don't know. I just think it's I think it's a fun coincidence. It's probably a coincidence. Michael Cole's probably like, what's his name again? Oh, he's the big guy. He's the big guy. Yeah, that's his name. I think it was Michael Cole that said it. It seems like something Michael Cole would say. It could have been Byron Saxton as well. He says stuff like that as well. He's a huge offender when it comes to saying stuff like that. Then we have Dean Ambrose versus Dolphin, and I don't know. Mauro calls Dean Rollins, which I don't know. Dean ends up winning a fine technical bout, but I don't know. It felt like it was missing something. It felt like it was missing any sort of depth to it. I feel like Dean's matches need to be a little bit more vicious. I think Dean needs to really hurt people. Not really hurt people, but you know what I mean. Have a little bit more of a mean streak in the ring and a sense of unpredictability. That would be good. Next, we have Naomi, Becky, and Carmella versus Natalia, Alexa Bliss, and Nikki Bella being their surprise partner. This is kind of shitty, but up until this point, the women didn't have anything to fight for on SmackDown, so I kind of understand them throwing them all into this big conglomeration of a match. and it gets Nikki Bella back there. She gets a decent face pop at points, and she's been booked as a face thus far. They actually turned Carmella, and now Nikki's a face and Carmella's supposed to be a heel, even though I'm not really sure how that works. The fans seemed kind of confused when that happened, like I said during my SmackDown review. I don't know if that's going to go over all that well, but we'll see. Who knows? Too many people for me, honestly. I wish they had something to fight over, but now that they have a women's championship, it's going to be so much better. And I think the SmackDown women's division has been booked so much better, considering that they don't have a women's championship. I think just the booking of the entire division has been so much stronger, while Raw only books anything with just two people at a time, which it seems like SmackDown is your place to get over, because everybody gets something. And the last one on here, we have Rollins versus Balor, and it's kind of a shame because I didn't take any notes for this one. I was really invested in watching this match, so I didn't actually get to write anything down, but it was a really good match, and I've talked about the buckle bomb and stuff like that. It's really cool that Finn Balor set his shoulder back into place midway through the match and then continued to wrestle and finished it. Finn Balor is going to be out for, I believe they said, 4 to 6 months. I think we should plan for 6. And there's so many plans that are coming out now. They're saying that Finn Balor would have feuded with Kevin Owens, which would have been awesome. Keep Seth and Roman out of the main event scene and have these other guys come in and really broaden the main event scene and what's possible there. And then it would have led to a triple threat with Kevin Owens, Chris Jericho, and Finn Balor at Hell in a Cell, which would have been awesome. It's awful that this is how everything turned out, that Finn Balor had to relinquish the championship. The belt itself, I don't have a major problem with it. I've said this. We have 4 belts with a very similar design. We have the Universal title, the World title, and the Women's titles on both SmackDown and Raw. And I think they should change both the Universal and World title designs, honestly. I think it looks so, that design itself looks so much better with the colored background behind the W, but also the white strap. I think that looks so much better, and the women's division has the best looking belts in WWE right now. And it works so much better for them than it would work for the guys. And it's a shame. You know what the worst thing out of this all is? The belt seems like it was designed specifically for Balor. It's the Balor belt. It looks so much like his demon stuff. It fit color-wise perfectly. And if somebody else wins it, I feel like they're just going to change the strap color. They'll just put another strap on it. And, you know, I'm fine with that, because if they designed a belt based entirely around the first person who would win it, then that's a little bit shallow in itself. I don't know what else they would do with it, honestly. I think they're probably just going to keep it how it is. Who's going to win? I would put my money on Rollins, but I really hope it's Kevin Owens. I really hope it's Kevin Owens. Kevin Owens is too good to not be in the main event scene. He's overdue for a world title run. He's one of the few people who's actually ready for it this early in his WWE career. Because Kevin Owens has actually not been around all that long, but he has all the tools. He's a really good wrestler. He's the perfect heel. I just think Kevin Owens has so much personality. He can bring out the best in any character. He's the most obnoxious guy ever. I really like him, but at the same time, I still do want to see him get his ass kicked. He's not quite on Miz level. I don't want to see The Miz win anything. And that's kind of what makes him the best heel in the company. That nobody wants to see The Miz win. Even if you appreciate his work, you don't want to see him win. But in the case of Kevin Owens, you still kind of want to see him win, but you still kind of want to see him get his ass kicked as well. He has a nice balance where The Miz has no redeeming quality as a face. Kevin Owens does. that's kind of what separates the two. So that's about all I have to say about SummerSlam. But before I wrap this up, I do want to talk about NXT TakeOver. Like I said, it's a predictable event. I called every single match, so I'm not going to spend too much time talking about it because it's pretty much exactly what you would expect if you look at the card. So let's just run through this real quick. They have these little dark matches. I think those are actually tapings for future episodes of NXT. I think these actually are going to be broadcasted on the network at some point. I believe that's how it works. I'm not entirely sure. But we have Ty Dillinger defeating Wesley Blake, which is from Blake and Murphy before they both went singles. And I don't know how Wesley Blake is doing these days. I'm glad Ty Dillinger got a W though. I want to see him on the main roster so bad. I'm not sure if he's ready, but I really do. We have the Authors of Pain, who have names apparently. I've never actually seen their names, but there's Akam and Razor. Those are terrible names. Those are awful names. They didn't have to give us their names. You could have just had them be the Authors of Pain. They both look similar enough that I'm not going to know the difference anyway, but whatever. With Paul Ellering defeating TM61, and I want to get into TM61. I kind of want to watch that match because I really want to like them, but I haven't gotten to see much out of them yet. I know they're capable of a lot because people are really high on them, but I haven't seen it yet. We have Austin Aries versus No Way Jose. Austin Aries wins by submission with that, I forgot what that move's called. It's like the inverted STF where you do a back bridge and you have the STF in, and I think that's a really cool move. No Way Jose showed a mean streak, but he shouldn't be beating Austin Aries. I kind of wonder, how many Intercontinental Championships do you think No Way Jose is going to hold before he retires? Your answer is probably 0, or it's like 5. You either are all in on No Way Jose or not at all. I really like No Way Jose. I don't think he's going to transfer well to the main roster, though. It's so sad. I want him to join Breezango, though, because they all have dancing kind of ish gimmicks. I guess Tyler Breeze doesn't really have a dancing gimmick. He's just kind of a twat. But I really do enjoy No Way Jose, and I think he would fit in very well on the main roster, especially with guys like that if he had to go heel. But his music is so fun. I don't know if anybody would really want to dislike him except if he were to develop X-Pac heat. And they're just thinking, I just don't want you on my TV. It's not killing me. It's just hurting me really, really bad. It's that type of feeling. Then we have the debut of Ember Moon, who comes out with these nice red contacts. I wish she wore more black or maybe more red. Instead, she wears like blue and orange with these red contacts that make her look really vicious, but the outfit just doesn't seem to fit. She goes over Billie Kay, who seems to be doing something similar to what Eva Marie did while she was on NXT, where she wrestled. She comes out in the big fluffy robe and everything. Yeah, you know what I mean. And it's cool, I guess. I mean, they're building her as kind of a diva. They're pretty much giving her the diva gimmick. The match was only like 4.5 minutes. So it wasn't all that much. But Ember Moon finishes it with this weird corkscrew stunner, which was really cool. I really did enjoy it. And I don't know. I haven't seen much out of her yet. I'm not particularly impressed, but I think that's because she was working with Billie Kay. And I don't know. There really wasn't much for them to give us with those two working together. I want to see Ember Moon work with Asuka. I know Asuka is built so much stronger than Ember Moon at this point, but I really do want to see them work together. I think they could both work really fun psychology because they're both vicious and they're both really, really intimidating in a way. Now let's talk about it. We're done with Ember Moon. We're done with Austin Aries. Bobby Roode. It was glorious. It was amazing. the best entrance I've ever seen in NXT, including the Nakamura one from tonight. Nakamura has a really good entrance, but it was just his normal entrance with a violin. And I would say that's still a top-notch entrance. But Bobby Roode, he's graceful as fuck. He comes down, I think he was singing his own music a little bit. Not actually, he was mouthing his own music a little bit, which is great. I'm glad he likes it as well. He's buying into it. He comes down from this giant pillar, which I didn't really understand, but it was really cool. It's one of those things that I didn't understand, but it was really cool. And I love when wrestling does that. When they make me wonder why I enjoy this so much. But it was great. Bobby Roode, he's just the perfect heel. And I think Bobby Roode is the replacement for Samoa Joe. And that Bobby Roode, I think they want him on the main roster, but he's going to play that Samoa Joe role. When Samoa Joe came to NXT, he was brought in to be a mentor, a guy to make everybody else look good, teach them the ropes. And he was really experienced and he knew what he was doing. Bobby Roode is very similar in that way. He's very experienced. He knows his character. He knows how to work within those ropes. He can play that mentor role to the same degree as Joe. And now that Joe has lost the title, he's free to go. Now they've gotten what they need out of Joe. Now he can move on to bigger events, make himself build a legend on the main roster. Because Samoa Joe can do that. They book him strongly on the main roster. There's no stopping him. There's no stopping him from being a star. I want Samoa Joe to be on SmackDown. I think he should be the top SmackDown heel. I mean, SmackDown does have some really good heels with AJ Styles. I mean, they could bring him in as a face and have him viewed with AJ Styles. That would be perfect. TNA all over again. Like, good TNA all over again. Not bad TNA. Not the one you're thinking of. It would be some of the best of TNA. Like, Samoa Joe and the X Division level TNA. That's perfect. Yeah, but Bobby Roode was pretty good. His finisher is a little bit underwhelming, but overall I think the match was cool. Andrade Almas, he did really shine in that match, and I'm starting to really come around on him. I just don't like his entrance gear. The way he looks when he comes in, he has the hat, he has the suspenders, and he's wearing all white, and that's cool and all, but then when he's wrestling, he looks completely different because he takes all that stuff off and he's wearing wrestling tights and he has spiked up hair. I think being so distinguishable from your entrance attire might be a little bit bad for somebody like Andrade Almas. He already has a name that doesn't roll off the tongue. Everything about him is really just hard to grasp. And I don't like that, but he's so good in the ring. I really do like him, and I think he has some natural charisma to him, though I haven't heard him cut any promos that I thought were particularly impressive. I really do like his... I really do enjoy his work in the ring. It's kind of like how Cesaro gets over, like when he does something clever in the ring and you just see him smile. That's kind of the feeling I get with Andrade Almas. I really enjoy it, but Bobby Roode ended up getting the W, and that was fine. The Revival end up going over Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa, and Was it Ciampa who tapped out? I think it was Gargano that tapped out. I don't even remember exactly. Like I said, didn't take notes on NXT because I was so into it. And there's a lot of animosity between Gargano and Ciampa since their match in the Cruiserweight Classic, which was an amazing match. I thought it was perfect. It was just wonderful. The match wasn't even the most creative, just the storytelling that those two did was some of the best I've seen in a little bit. Like, two friends going at it, if you want to see that story done well, that is a perfect example between those two. And I'm fine with this because they're both probably going to go up to the main roster soon and compete in the Cruiserweight division, which is where they belong because they're great. I love them. They won my heart with their match in the CWC, and I really hope that Ciampa, especially with his amazing storytelling that he had in that match, that he's going to be the Cruiserweight champion sooner rather than later. Now all we have left are the two main events, where we have the women's match and the NXT championship match. Both were solid matches. We have Asuka going over Bayley, which is a given now that we have Bayley on the main roster, which is great. Can't wait to see Asuka there too, but I'm not sure who's going to dethrone her. I hope Ember Moon turns out to be really awesome and we get to see more of her, and I hope that she's as good as the hype says, because that would be great to have a match between Asuka and Ember Moon. I think it's going to be really cool going forward with the women's division on NXT because they've introduced so many more people. I want them to really develop all these characters. Their talent that's really rusty, and I guess that's kind of fun to follow. See if they get better. You can see them really from a point where they were struggling and see if they go anywhere. And you know that not many of them are going to go anywhere, but we can hope for the best with them. In the case of Asuka defeating Bayley, I thought that was a fine match. Nakamura versus Samoa Joe, it was a very stiff match. We have Nakamura breaking Joe's jaw, and that's probably going to put a little bit of a weight on Samoa Joe's call-up to the main roster. He's probably going to get one more match against Nakamura at the next TakeOver, and then he's coming up to the main roster. If he wins the title again, then that's something. He could win the title again from Nakamura and then Nakamura come up to the main roster in a similar way to the Revival's relationship with American Alpha, which I think was a mistake personally. I think Revival should have definitely come up to the main roster and American Alpha should have held the belts a little bit longer, but that's just me. So that's pretty much it. I think I've talked about everything that I have to. I've talked about the safety in wrestling. I've talked about the belt, the new belt. I've talked about TakeOver. I've talked about SummerSlam. That's it, guys. We've gone through a lot here. This is the longest episode I've done in a while. And I know I didn't do the NXT thing this week. I didn't do the CWC this week. I'm going to try to get back onto that. We'll see. It's hard to make 3 podcasts a week, but I really enjoy doing it. Thank you guys for tuning in. If you want to check me out on social media, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter. All the links are in the description box below. YouTube, iTunes, Dailymotion. Facebook has been blowing up a little bit bigger recently. And I'm going to be putting a lot more of my predictions on Facebook in the upcoming months for big events going forward. I just think that's much easier than producing a full podcast just for predictions. Though I really do enjoy doing the prediction podcast. I think they take up more time than they should for what they're supposed to be accomplishing. So, wrapping this up, thank you guys for tuning in. I'll catch you guys next time with another episode of Noisebleed. Probably will be out on Tuesday, because I have to do the Raw episode. So, I'll see you guys then. See you next time.